massive car bomb exploded outside of a large federal building in downtown Oklahoma City, shattering that building, killing children, killing federal employees, military men, and civilians.
The chaos in downtown Oklahoma City did indeed resemble Beirut after what police believe to be a 1,200-pound car bomb ripped through the nine-story federal building shortly after 9 o'clock this morning.
If it seemed like war...
It's like a garbage pile. It's unbelievable. Everywhere you dig, you find somebody. Everywhere.
I found myself this morning looking back at things and thinking of things that I didn't really think about during the... During the thing, and tears still come to my eyes.
Seemed like war.
They are saying there's an 8-foot crater, and a couple of cars at least have been joined by the heat and the force of the explosion.
In Lebanon, a spokesman for the Iranian-backed Hezbollah said, "We are only interested in liberating our land from the Israeli occupation. We have no relation with the explosion inside the United States."
There you see the farmhouse right now. This is where two individuals, we believe two, maybe more, were being sought.
Seemed like war.
That's a farmhouse said to be owned by two brothers with possible links to the bombing. They are identified as James Douglas Nichols and Terry Lynn Nichols. Law enforcement sources say those two men and McVeigh were expelled from a paramilitary group for being too radical. Officials are refusing to speculate on what motive any of these suspects might have.
He told me earlier this evening, having to do with experiments in bomb making and a passionate anger against the federal government for its actions against the Branch Davidians in Waco, Texas 2 years back, is circumstantial but telling.
One suspect, according to our sources, is in custody now.
27-year-old Tim McVeigh, the crew cut John Doe number one in the FBI sketch, had been stopped for speeding in this Mercury Marquee, 60 miles north of Oklahoma City, about 90 minutes after the bombing.
Reno hinted at a wider conspiracy.
I remind everyone that John Doe number 2 remains at large. He should be considered armed and extremely dangerous. There is a strong likelihood that other persons are involved in this tragedy as well.
Seemed like war.
Hello, and welcome to the Deathcast. I'm best-selling author Ian Totten. I'd like to thank you for joining me as we prepare to take our second look at the Oklahoma City bombing. Before we get into this week's installment, I have the normal show notes and plugs. If you would like to follow me anywhere on social media, just search for Ian Totten, author, the Deathcast, or Corpse Creek Publishing. If you enjoy what I do, would like to sign up for the show's official mailing list, just go to CorpseCreekPublishing.com, click on the subscribe button. You can get updates on new show releases, Patreon episodes, that sort of thing. While there, please consider making a donation to the show. Buy me a cup of coffee or a pack of smokes. If you really enjoy the show, please consider becoming a Patreon member. You can go to tinyurl.com/DCPatreon. For as little as $2 a month, you can help support the show and get exclusive content while you're there. First exclusive episode is up. There are more in the works as we speak. If you don't have the money to spend, I understand times are tough. Go to your favorite podcast app, subscribe to the show there, leave a 5-star review. They really do help get the show out to more people, and I will read your review on air. All right, now that all of that is out of the way, get yourself something to drink, find a nice comfy chair, kick back, relax. I've got my coffee, I've got my cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt. When we left off last episode, we had gone through a basic timeline of events for April 19th through roughly the 21st of 1995, the actual bombing of the Mira building in Oklahoma City. We also discussed one of the reasons that was discovered by law enforcement as to why the perpetrators of the attack, that would be Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols, did what they did, and that would be the siege at Ruby Ridge. This week, we're going to be looking at the second reason why, at least according to McVeigh, he decided that he needed to strike back against the United States government for what he saw as oppressive actions against the populace, and that would be the siege at Waco, Texas. I know this particular story has been covered to death by the media, but I do think it is important to go over the facts of the case as opposed to the official government narrative, because that has been proven in court to be unreliable. So much so that the Branch Davidians still exist and still believe David Koresh to have been their messiah. Not all of them, but a good amount of them, especially those who were able to survive the assault by the FBI and the ATF. So the Branch Davidians, led by David Koresh, were an offshoot of the Seventh-day Adventists. They were really an apocalyptic religious sect that believed the end was nigh, and as such were preparing for that. They bought an area of land actually outside of Waco, Texas, in Axtell, Texas, where they built a fairly large compound to help bring in money to the group. Their leader, a man by the name of David Koresh, who was born Vernon Wayne Howell, began selling guns at gun shows. This is the first important aspect of this particular case, because later the ATF would try and claim that he was illegally selling assault rifles, something that in court was proven to be factually wrong. Davidians, so far as their sale of weaponry, did everything above board. They had all the required permits, both state and federal. For some reason, the ATF decided that they were going to stake them out and eventually raid the compound. And for those of the younger listeners out there, you've never experienced anything like the news coverage that came out when the Branch Davidian compound was laid siege to by the FBI and the ATF. Because the story, right from the get-go, from the federal government and the media, was they were selling illegal guns, there was sexual abuse of children going on, all of which that was denied by the Branch Davidians. And in fact, the sheriff of Axtell, Texas, said, basically, I don't know why they're doing this. They haven't done anything wrong. So the ATF ends up renting a property down the road, pretty much directly across the street from the Mount Carmel Center. And as the story goes, someone from the Branch Davidians was down at a store that was nearby and was told by a local, basically, hey, you guys are about to be raided. And they went back to Mount Carmel to inform Koresh and the others that the federal government was preparing to move in on them. This was honestly a surprise to most of those within the building, including Koresh himself. There are conflicting stories about what happened next. Part of this is due to the fact that the front door to the building was taken by the federal government after the siege and has never been shown to the public, has never been released. Basically, Koresh went to the door to see what was going on. The ATF contends that the Branch Davidians shot first. The Branch Davidians contend contend that the ATF opened fire first. Regardless of what happened, Koresh ended up getting hit and withdrawing into the compound. What ended up happening was a, believe, 51-day siege in which the FBI got involved. Now, during all of this, the federal law enforcement agencies involved, who already had egg on their face for their bungling of the Ruby Ridge fiasco, began putting out all sorts of stories through the media. There's all actually accounts of them doing a blackout of the media, who were putting out stories that went against the narrative that the government wanted out there, which was that David Koresh and his followers were an apocalyptic doomsday cult who were stockpiling and selling illegal weapons. There were stories put out there that they were running a methamphetamine lab out of the compound, and that there was rampant child sexual abuse going on within the Branch Davidian sect. On the first day of the standoff, the ATF ended up running out of ammunition, so they went basically into a wait-and-see mode. To further illustrate the point that the Branch Davidians were not, in fact, this, you know, anti-government sect, once the ATF ran out of ammunition, they allowed the agents to gather their dead and wounded. The ceasefire, however, would not last, as at roughly 11:30 a.m., a Branch Davidian by the name of Michael Schroeder was shot dead by ATF agents who contended that he opened fire on them with a pistol, an allegation that has never been proven. Not long after this, the FBI came involved. Koresh began giving interviews with the local media via telephone, and the FBI, not wanting to have the story that they were building destroyed by this, turned around and cut the telephone lines into the building. With the exception that the Branch Davidians were allowed to only contact the FBI negotiators, Koresh was able to finagle it that a audio recording that he had made was broadcast on national radio. Some sources state that the deal was that this would be done and then the Branch Davidians would surrender, although Koresh told the FBI agents that he had been informed by God that he needed to stay within the compound and wait. Afterwards, a number of children were released from the Branch Davidian compound, and 98 individuals still remained inside. There were a number of videos sent from within the compound by Koresh and the Branch Davidians, and these two were used by the federal government in order to paint those who were within side as violent religious fanatics. Somewhere during this 51-day siege, Timothy McVeigh, who was out of the military for a few years, arrived on scene. And the things that he saw, particularly on the last day, it said, is what drove him over the edge and firmly entrenched him in his belief that the federal government was a tyrannical organization that needed to have war openly declared upon it. To give you an idea of the spin that was put on the siege by the federal government through the media, Koresh began being referred to as the Wacko in Waco, and has really continued to be portrayed in that light by both the media and the federal government since the time of the siege. Another interesting point of fact, the federal government tried to contend after the events that the FBI had not used any snipers on scene, although it was discovered that there were, in fact, sniper nests as well as shells fired from the guns known to have been used by the FBI's hostage rescue team. I bring this up because a key player in the Ruby Ridge assault also participated in the massacre at Waco. That's our buddy from the last episode, FBI sniper Lon Hurucci. There are photos of him standing outside of Waco with his gun in his camouflage, smiling and give the thumbs up. The indication of the photos being that he had killed somebody with his sniper rifle. Hurucci is one of the individuals seen by McVeigh and others in the white separatists movement as an enemy. I mean, to the point that there are stories out there, whether they're true or not, I do not know, that people actually put hits out on this guy. That is how much he is despised, as he is seen as nothing more than a hired murderer for the federal government. In any event, on day 51 of the siege at Waco, Janet Reno authorized the FBI hostage rescue team to mount an assault. She did this because the individuals on scene informed her that massive, wide-scale child abuse was taking place inside of the compound, and that negotiations had deteriorated to the point that they believed that the Branch Davidians were going to commit a mass suicide. This despite the fact that both Koresh and those who had been released sporadically over the course of the siege clearly stated that they had no such intentions and that no child abuse was taking place inside. Later, Reno, when pressed on the issue, would state that it was her belief that the hostage rescue team had grown tired with waiting and just wanted to end the entire affair. My personal belief is that the FBI had grown tired of waiting and knew that unless they eliminated those who were inside and were able to press charges and lock up those who had been released, they were going to face a massive public relations nightmare, which in the decades since the assault is exactly what happened. So on April 19th, 1993, this is 2 years before the Oklahoma City bombing, the FBI hostage rescue team sent in numerous combat engineered vehicles. They punched holes in the walls of the buildings of the compound using explosives so that they could ostensibly pour tear gas into the building. According to the FBI later, the plan was to increasingly pump more amounts of tear gas into the facility in order to force a surrender on the part of the Branch Davidians. However, that is not what happened. Inside the compound, you have to imagine there was mass pandemonium as many of the Branch Davidians who remained inside either put on gas masks or went down into a concrete bunker that had been built underneath the building. At roughly noon, three fires broke out within the Branch Davidian compound. While the government states that the fires were deliberately set by the Branch Davidians, survivors of the assault contend that the federal government did it either by accident or on purpose. In any event, the end result was that 76 people died inside the Branch Davidian compound, with 9 escaping. The federal government contended that many of those who died inside the building were killed by other members of the Branch Davidian, pointing as proof children who were found in the death throes, stating that this was obvious evidence of cyanide poisoning. Those who don't believe the official narrative basically state that those who died by gunshot wounds only did so because there was no possible way for them to escape the fire as exits had been blocked, although some evidence has been produced to show that those who were within the bunker may have been able to escape had they desired to. The majority of the Branch Davidian adults who survived ended up being convicted on various charges. Again, my personal opinion, this was the government covering its own ass for the use of force after receiving false intel, as they stated that by firing back at federal officials, they had committed a crime. Again, this is a very condensed version of what happened in Waco. Actually, a friend of mine, Ed Opperman, did an interview with survivors of the siege, which can be found over on his Spreaker page in his archives. One of the interviews I know that is over there is with a Branch Davidian who died this year by the name of Clive Doyle. He was actually able to escape from the fire, and it paints a much different picture of what actually took place within the compound during the siege, but also of life within the Mount Carmel Center. So anybody who is interested in hearing a side other than the federal government or the media's interpretation of what the federal government told them, I recommend you go and seek it out. Again, that's the Opperman Report on Spreaker. Just type in Clive Doyle. So there are the two reasons that both McVeigh and the federal government eventually decided were at the root of McVeigh's hatred for the U.S. government, but there was more to Timothy McVeigh than just that, and we're going to delve into his life a bit at this point. Timothy James McVeigh was born on April 23rd, 1968, in Lockport, New York. He was the only son born to Mildred and William McVeigh. Mildred was known by friends and family as Mickey. People that knew the couple said that Bill worshipped the ground that his wife walked on, while Mickey basically treated him as a doormat. It has been noted that McVeigh's father was a very shy individual, while his mother liked to spend her time going out with her friends, carousing and drinking. When he was 8, McVeigh's mother took a job for a travel agency and was away for quite a bit of time. Some who knew the family stated that because McVeigh's father worked a graveyard shift, Mickey, who was working at this travel agency, was able to basically do whatever it was she wanted, which in this case meant that she was able to go running around to bars and pick up men. Some have even stated that she was, quote-unquote, wasn't much of a housewife, and their home was always messy. This because being domesticated was not, in any way, shape, or form, what McVeigh's mother was looking for out of life. Everyone who knew her has stated that she craved attention from the opposite sex, excitement, and adventure. While McVeigh himself described his mother as freewheeling, a free spirit. Eventually, McVeigh's father, Bill, began to suspect, and I assume rightfully so, that his wife was cheating on him. This led to the disillusionment of their marriage. McVeigh, in fact, believed that his father's own friends were carrying on affairs with his mother. According to defense witnesses, it was believed by McVeigh's defense team that his mother, because of her alcoholism, encouraged unhealthy sexual relationships among her children, although this has never been absolutely proven to be fact. And in fact, McVeigh's sisters have gone on the record as stating that this was not in any way, shape, or form true, although their mother was known to encourage McVeigh's older sister to drink with her, especially when things such as breaking up with a boyfriend took place. On describing a young Timothy McVeigh, friends and acquaintances stated that he was a shy and reserved boy who was known to have a short temper. He's also been described as being somewhat of a nerd who, by his own admission, was bullied very heavily in school. One interesting story concerning McVeigh comes from a neighbor. You have to remember that McVeigh's mother, even when she was married to his father, was very seldom home, and when she was less than attentive. So McVeigh's neighbors, many of them women, took to being something of a surrogate mothers to him. According to this one individual, she always suspected that something, quote-unquote, disturbing had happened to Tim McVeigh within the McVeigh household. To quote this woman, McVeigh had a poor body image and often wore baggy clothing to cover the shape of his body. I have always sensed that Tim had a deep hurt he could never talk about, and I always felt that it could have something to do with his mother. This, again, goes into the possibility that McVeigh's mother may have sexually abused him, although, again, this has never been proven or disproven. McVeigh's grandfather, Ed, was really his safety release. McVeigh spent a lot of time with his grandfather, in fact, seemed to cherish the opportunity to be around the older man. It was through his grandfather that McVeigh first came into contact with guns, and Ed taught him how to properly and safely handle firearms. McVeigh stated about his grandfather, quote, I used to nap on his couch. When I woke, we'd fold blankets together, him holding the end as I picked up the corners. Eventually, he taught me how to fold a blanket by myself. I loved going to his house. McVeigh has classified his grandfather as something of a mechanical MacGyver. Something that McVeigh himself attempted to emulate in his own life, stating, quote, occasionally the MacGyver influence comes out in me. McVeigh also stated that while his grandfather was a rugged individual, he was also the only person he could truly claim to have loved. When McVeigh was 9 in 1978, his parents finally separated, with Mickey moving out. McVeigh's sisters chose to stay with their mother while Tim went and lived with his father. After his mother and sisters left, it's been said that McVeigh became distant, disconnected, and guarded. While a close friend of the family stated he, quote, became noticeably insecure, unable to find his niche, almost starved for affection, having an impenetrable shell around him which hardly anybody could break through. And this really paints the picture of who McVeigh would be as an adult. The media tried to paint this picture of him as being this heartless, bloodthirsty individual. I personally believe that's not the case. I'm not saying that what McVeigh did was good, but I do believe that because of the traumas that he experienced during early childhood, he built this shell up around himself under the belief of, if you don't know who I really am, then you can't hurt me. We will get back to looking at McVeigh in just a moment. From author Alistair Cross comes the Vampires of Crimson Cove series. When the sun goes down and the fog rolls in, the darkness comes out to play in the little town of Crimson Cove. By day, it's an idyllic mountain village, but after sunset, stay inside and lock your doors. Between dusk and dawn, the streets run red with blood. Two brothers, Brooks and Cade Coulter, know all about the darkness. One fights it, and the other is part of it. And although he tries to stay on the side of light, can you ever really trust a vampire? This is what New York Times best-selling author of the Walking Dead series, Jay Onansinga, has to say. Put Bram Stoker in a giant cocktail shaker. Add a pinch of Laura K. Hamilton, a shot of John Carpenter, and a healthy jigger of absinthe, and you'll end up with Alistair Cross's modern gothic chiller, The Crimson Corset, a deliciously terrifying tale that will sink its teeth into you from page one. The Vampires of Crimson Cove series is available on Amazon in paperback, ebook, and Audible. Also available on Kindle Unlimited. We are back. As I said before the break, McVeigh had built this shell around himself to keep people from learning who he really was inside. Because of this, the glimpses of McVeigh that the people who knew him encountered were of a really geeky guy who, once high school began, was really, really into firearms as well as computers. That's one aspect about McVeigh that is often overlooked. Although he was an absolutely awful student in school, he was seen as something as of a whiz kid with computers. By his own admission, McVeigh was, you know, an original hacker, so to speak, using his Commodore 64 to hack into government databases under the handle of the Wanderer. Just as an aside, it is odd that the federal government, when he eventually did go into the United States Army, did not take advantage of this ability of his to understand and use computers. But that could also be tied into the fact that eventually McVeigh would hold illusions that he wanted to be a member of the special forces. McVeigh's mother would return to the house periodically over the ensuing years until 1984, when she took McVeigh's two sisters and moved to Florida. From this point on, it was simply McVeigh, his father, and on occasion his grandfather. During his high school years, in addition to being heavily into computers, is when McVeigh began to show an interest in survivalism. As he told his biographers, quote, "I grew up during the Cold War era. People had built bomb shelters in their backyards. The McDermotts had a basement with walls that were 8 feet thick. It was a fallout shelter in their basement. They told me the guy who built the house was worried about radiation from bomb fallout. My uncle's former house had its own gas tank and underground pump. During the gas crisis of 1974, I remember a neighbor coming in the middle of the night siphoning gas from my dad's car and other neighbors' cars. Gas was gold, and it was being stolen from our driveway. That instilled a feeling of righteousness in me. A feeling that you should be able to defend your property. I wanted to sit outside and guard our property. You couldn't just shoot him because you're not in fear for your life. You start thinking that the laws aren't in line with what I would call natural law." McVeigh was not alone during this period of time, the early 1980s, in his belief in survivalism. In fact, it was something of a phenomenon across the United States, with families building bomb shelters and taking survivalist courses. This was really just a resurgence of what had taken place in the 1950s. McVeigh, however, was different in that he continued these survivalist ways up until the day that he was arrested. But to give you a broader idea of how it was in the 1980s, especially the early 1980s, a lot of religious programs began preaching about the end of times and the coming of Christ. Individuals like Pat Robertson, the 700 Club, organizations like that, these televangelists began preaching about it, and thousands upon thousands of Americans ate their words up and began preparing themselves for this coming nuclear war. McVeigh started earlier than some, however, as by his own admission, the blizzard of 1977, which saw 15 feet of snow dumped on the town of Pendleton, where McVeigh and his father lived. According to the book Aberration in the Heartlands of the Real, The Many Lives of Timothy McVeigh, it was during this blizzard where his mother had gone off to visit friends and become stranded away from the home that McVeigh finally felt abandoned by not only his mother but really everyone else within his life, and decided that he needed to survive on his own if he was going to be able to do anything in this life. As to his mind, he could not rely on anyone else. According to McVeigh, his definition of survivalism was attaining personal freedom through separation and independence from the system. It's a yearning to live the Ingalls on the little house on the prairie, a wholesome and pure life. I see nothing wrong with that. For younger fans who don't know, The Ingalls and the Little House on a Prairie was a book series by Laura Ingalls Wilder, but also a massively popular television series that aired through the 1970s and into the 1980s. After this blizzard, it was noted by people that knew the McVeighs that Tim became increasingly remote and distant. In fact, he became meticulous and studious in the study of his various hobbies, which included computers, weaponry, and survivalism. He also lost himself within comic books, which gives some idea of the quote-unquote dork that McVeigh was, because during this period of time, really, the only people that read comic books were considered the nerds and the dorks. It wasn't like it is now, where it was mainstream. Back then, they were seen as kids' things. One thing that McVeigh focused a lot of time and attention on was perfecting his marksmanship with guns. His grandfather was a pretty big hunter from all accounts. McVeigh never showed much interest in hunting, however, he did relish the idea of becoming an expert marksman. And as the years go on, almost all of McVeigh's attention turns to both survivalism and guns. He was so enthralled with guns, gun ownership, and the entire lifestyle that during a career day, he listed at his future occupation as being a gun store owner. This, coupled with the budding fantasy life that he was building up within his own mind, were, for lack of better terms, a dangerous combination. Tim already felt alienated from society as a whole due to his home life and the fact that he was not very popular within school. He also found ways to lose himself in movies such as War Games, which he cited as quite possibly his favorite film. And that links up perfectly with his survivalist leanings. If you have not seen the movie, War Games is a story of a high school student played by Matthew Broderick, who's a computer hacker who ends up hacking into the federal government's computer systems looking for games, and ends up initiating a war game with the computer, although Broderick's character, as well as the federal government, does not understand that it is just a simulation, a game. So everyone gets into a panic, believing that this computer, which they cannot get to stop this countdown, is actually going to start World War III. Discussing his interest in computers later, McVeigh stated, "I was on the internet before it became popular. I kept inputting different phone numbers. I hacked into banks, government agencies. I hacked into more shit on computers than I'd ever admit to. I had a Commodore 64 computer at home. Dave Darlak and myself hacked into people's computers from school. I learned how to charge phone calls to other people's phones. One way we were hacking around and a message came up, 'You're on the system illegally and will turn off your phones.' The next day I was scared to even take out the garbage. I thought the cops would come. I got in a White Sands missile range computer system. White Sands was government computer, but I didn't get past their password. I love the movie War Games. I was inspired by that movie." One also has to imagine that McVeigh found films such as The Road Warrior, which was the second part to Mad Max, to be particularly fascinating, as McVeigh, again, saw himself as a survivalist and mentally liked to put himself into the roles of the main characters as he daydreamed through his life. Another film that McVeigh said influenced him greatly during this period of time was the movie Red Dawn, which is about an invasion of the United States by Russian forces and a group of high school students that go off into the wilderness and battle with them. Again, all types of things that fed into McVeigh's starving psyche. Unlike the lone wolf narrative that has been put out about McVeigh during his high school years, while he was quiet and withdrawn, it was noted that he was placed into advanced placement classes, had near perfect attendance, decent enough school grades, and got along with everyone within his school. He was one of those individuals that kind of floated from group to group, never joining one of them. It was said that he did not smoke, drink, or do drugs. An interesting bit of information from his high school years is that, to the best of anyone's knowledge, while he did have a crush on a girl that was in his biology class, it is not known whether Tim McVeigh ever had a girlfriend or experienced any sort of intimacy with a woman in his life. McVeigh was on the football team in high school as well as the track and field team. One student that attended class with him stated that Tim was outgoing and active, but was also an unconnected loner on the fringes of teenage social life. Well, a family friend stated that he was always on the outside looking in, wanting a place to fit in. He never quite made what he wanted to make or achieved what he wanted to achieve. It seemed like no matter what he did, he didn't quite make it. Not as a son to his mother or father in any of the groups the other kids were involved in. McVeigh himself stated that he did in fact date in high school and lost his virginity during his junior year to a co-worker. McVeigh stated that she quote-unquote liked his stamina and that he was a quote young buck. I personally don't believe that this particular anecdote is true. It sounds more likely than not that McVeigh was trying to paint a picture of himself of being a manly man, so to speak, the kind that beds women with disregard to their marital or relationship status and then moves from one sexual liaison to another with ease. If you've ever watched interviews with Tim McVeigh or read any of his biographies, he was anything but, as I stated, he was a, lack of a better term, a dork. You know, he was into comic books. books and guns and survivalism and Star Trek, that kind of stuff, not the type of activities that a young man in the early 1980s would be involved with were he a quote-unquote stud. One woman who has claimed to have dated him at some period of time stated that he was loud and goofy, although she sensed that he was lost. Again, there is no record as to whether or not they had had an intimate relationship. It seems more likely than not that Tim took her out on weekly dates during his senior year in high school before they broke up. With this relationship, too, Tim talks about his sexual prowess, stating that he was horny and got her on the pill by taking her to Planned Parenthood because he was an honorable young man, but eventually things just fizzled out. From this point on, Tim is not known to have had any other relationships, although he liked to boast of having bedded the wives of his friends. Again, I believe this too is, you know, a massive exaggeration on his part in order to make himself seem more quote-unquote manly. After graduating high school, McVeigh had few options for gainful employment as this period in time, the U.S. economy was really feeling the crunch of various industries like steel mills and auto factories closing down. McVeigh, due to his IQ, had gotten a small scholarship to a state college, Bryant and Stratton Business College. He went there for computers, but after only a few short months, McVeigh, who had scored nearly perfect on the math entrance exam, grew bored and dropped out. After dropping out of school, Tim applied for and received a concealed carry permit. After this, he sold his comic book collection, which years earlier he had referred to as his college fund, and purchased 10 acres of land in conjunction with a friend from high school. In order to support himself, McVeigh got a job working at a local gun shop. When he wasn't at the gun shop, he would be out on this 10 acres of land hunting and shooting his guns, living the survivalist's dream, as it were. Eventually, I would assume more out of boredom than anything else, McVeigh got a second job, this working as an armored truck driver at Burke Armored Security in Buffalo. According to McVeigh, again, I believe this is him building up his ego. Everyone that he worked with referred to him as the kid due to the fact that he could quote-unquote outshoot everybody. People that worked with McVeigh at this armored truck company remember him as what one person called a gun nut. Another person described an incident wherein McVeigh showed up to work wearing two bandoleros looking like quote-unquote Pancho Villa or some Old West outlaw. It was during these years after high school that McVeigh really began to embrace the survivalist mentality more so than he had when he was in high school, as McVeigh now could legally go to gun shows and was introduced to a new subculture within the survivalist's world. That would be the militiamen, individuals that get together on the weekends to hold drills and dress in camouflage, stand guard duty, that type of stuff. McVeigh came within their sphere and began reading magazines such as Soldier of Fortune, a magazine noted for lambasting the political left, as well as for having articles and recruitment ads to hire mercenaries to go battle on behalf of the Nicaraguan Contra rebels. It was through the pages of Soldier of fortune that McVeigh encountered what may be the single biggest turning point in his life. And that was an advertisement for a book called The Turner Diaries. For those unfamiliar with The Turner Diaries, it was written and published in 1978 under the pseudonym Andrew McDonald. The actual author was a former physics professor by the name of William Pierce. Pierce is the deceased founder of the National Alliance. The National Alliance is a right-wing extremist organization with ties to the Vanguard, the Sword and the Shield, the White Aryan Resistance, the American Nazi Party, Stormfront website, on and on and on. Anybody who has ever been to a heavy metal concert in the last 25 years or so may actually have met members of the National Alliance without even realizing it. They like to go to heavy metal concerts and hand out CDs outside of the venue, usually afterwards, to concert goers. Usually these CDs carry the label of Resistance Records. I know myself, a friend of I went to a Danzig concert, and as we were leaving, somebody handed us a CD. We had no idea what it was, and it wasn't until later when we decided to play it to see what kind of music it was, we realized that it was white nationalist music, with bands such as Screwdriver, Blue Eyed Devil, numerous whites-only bands who espouse a white nationalistic, oftentimes Christian identity, neo-Nazi mindset. So for anybody who tells you, you know, that these groups aren't active or anything like that, I can tell you from my own experience, I've encountered them at concerts. That was the first time. That's not the last time I've encountered them at concerts. They seek out the young, white, and disenfranchised within society. Anyways, this book, The Turner Diaries, is extremely popular with the white nationalist movement. The book consists of diary entries from a character by the name of Earl Turner, who has grown disillusioned with society. He sees the increasing multiculturalism, restrictive gun ownership legislation, various other things as a threat to the white race, which is led by the Zionist Occupied Government, or ZOG, as in this book it is explained that the Jews seek to enslave mankind, particularly white men. Also in this book, in these diary entries, goes on to list off increasing terroristic activities by Turner and his cohorts against non-white individuals who are their enemies. The end of the book, Turner and his cohorts achieve success after blowing up a supercomputer in the FBI building. One thing of note is that they use a truck bomb. This computer is used to track white individuals for control by the government. So this wonderfully crappy piece of literature was and still is a wet dream to those within the white nationalists movement. Almost a blueprint, if you will, for those who are within it, as evidenced by numerous white nationalist crimes during the 1980s and 1990s. This includes the Oklahoma City bombing. So McVeigh, who is already alienated into the survivalist world, he first encounters this book and it basically becomes almost like his Bible. As this book really laid the foundation for his political and sociological beliefs. And that is important to make note of, because there are those who believe that McVeigh was not a racist and did not believe within in the white power movement. By his own admission and by evidence, we are going to see how McVeigh was not only involved with but supported the white power movement through the United States. On the book, McVeigh states, "Exposed me to racism I wasn't familiar with. It's very anti-black." McVeigh further stated, and mind you, that he said this after he had been arrested. He realized everyone is an individual. This he continued to profess until the day he died, that everyone was an individual, and that the aspect of the book he really gravitated towards was the survivalist anti-government message contained within the pages. It was through these gun stores and working at Burke and magazines like Soldier of Fortune and the Turner Diaries that Tim McVeigh became aware of the subculture of what the white nationalist movement. McVeigh ended up being promoted at his job at Burke, although eventually, because of the various things that McVeigh was involved in, his performance at work began to suffer. To quote one former co-worker, "We saw Timothy McVeigh, most high school students never knew, a man influenced by war and weapon literature, angry over his home life and living in a survivalist fantasy world." Eventually, co-workers began to notice McVeigh was becoming increasingly hyperactive and high-strung. His intensity levels began to increase, and he was noted that he was jittery and jumpy, as well as the fact that he began to carry guns with him to work whenever he could. While his temper had grown shorter, with numerous colleagues stating he would fly off the handle at the drop of the hat only to quickly calm down, and other days it was almost as though he wasn't there. That's how withdrawn McVeigh would become. By McVeigh's own admission, during this period of time, he became frustrated and disenchanted with the mundane actions of his day-to-day life. He began seeking a higher purpose and calling. McVeigh began to quote lines from the Turner Diaries. This one in particular that I am about to read was a favorite of his and illustrated his dissatisfaction and disillusionment with life. For those of you who may be bothered by this reading, you may want to fast forward a few seconds. "The chains that bind us are formed slowly, one link at a time, so we never notice the additional weight of one additional link, but eventually it forms a chain." Quoting McVeigh now, "I loved that passage. It was right on. Most Americans could give a shit as long as they have a six-pack of beer and their TV is working." It was because of this growing disillusionment that on May 12, 1988, just after turning 20 years old, Timothy McVeigh drove to the Federal Building in Buffalo, New York, and walked into the Army Recruitment Office and informed the individual there that he had this desire to become an airborne ranger, Green Beret, or some other branch of the Special Forces. After being reassured that after boot camp he would have the opportunity to pursue whatever it was that he wanted to do, McVeigh ended up enlisting. Many who knew McVeigh saw his enlistment as a natural progression for him, as McVeigh had been very pro-government, very pro-Republican Party, pro-Reaganism. And that may have been true up to a point, but as we've already seen, despite his leanings, McVeigh was already growing extremely disillusioned with the ties that bind you. So his joining of the military may have been a looking for some form of real structure and change in his life, and B, a means to an end, as he wished to be a survivalist, and the best way to for him to get the most top-of-the-line training was for him to go into the armed forces and get into a special forces program. We are going to leave our story for this week. We will pick it up again next week when we discuss McVeigh's time in the military, what happened after, and the events leading up to the bombing itself. I hope you have enjoyed this episode of the Death Cast. Again, if you like the show, please consider becoming a patron at tinyurl.com/DCPatreon. Little as $2 a month, you can help support the show and get bonus content. Like and subscribe wherever it is that you get your favorite podcasts, and leave a 5-star review. The Death Cast is a production of Corpse Creek Publishing. Until next time, stay morbid.